My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead. Just a couple reminders about, love you to fill out teaching session evaluations. These are generic evaluations for whatever, whichever sessions you've attended and returned in the little envelope in the dining hall. And we also have general village evaluations, which we'd love to get your feedback on too before you leave. So thank you in advance for that. Last session for the week, Paul.
Amen, sister.
Oh, come on.
Days off before he starts again. So thank you for your time here, Paul, and we're going to learn about Joseph and his brothers, Walter and Joseph.
We are indeed. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome. The matins this morning was perfect because it reminded us that every day is a new present and now. And it's really important for teachers here to remember that every day there are people in the session who have been here all week. And so I try to begin with a little synopsis of where we've been, and frankly, I think that's helpful for the people who've been here, too. You know, and for those of you who are new to the village, especially if you're staying a while, I am teaching the same thing next week. So spoiler alert, you're going to get the end of the book, but we're used to reading the Bible in snippets, and we never get all of the Bible, so know that you're welcome to come back next week. And also, I'm learning that this is not widely known. These sessions are taped, and they are available online. So if you were out on a hike and missed a session and want to catch up, that's available to you. I don't know how soon those are posted. So what we've been doing with the help of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, whose book, Not in God's Name, Confronting Religious Violence, has been kind of central for both Gary and me, is trying to build a theology of the other. And yesterday we got to hear that very poignantly when Jacob is reconciled to Esau and he said, to see your face is like seeing the face of God. And the amazing thing about the book of Genesis is that it tells this story about our siblings. So we've been telling sibling stories all week, but it's telling a cosmic story. It's telling a global story. It's on one level. At every turn, it's about the Israelites in Egypt. Hagar is an Egyptian, the Ishmaelites. I mean, Joseph is going to be sold down into slavery in Egypt. So similar to the book of Exodus, it's already about this tension between Israel and Egypt, this kind of cosmic huge thing. It's about dealing with strangers and all of that. On another level, it's about getting along with your brothers and sisters. And that we've been trying to hold those together. So by today, if you've been along all week, you can see the sweep of this sort of for options for getting along in the world. It starts with Cain and Abel in Genesis 4. If you don't get along with somebody, kill them, right? Well, this is an option. And we learned there about the evolution of cooperation and competition, of altruism versus survival, and the way we need the survival of the fittest is tied up in cooperation within groups, but it also creates hostility between competing groups. So he does his careful work in evolution, and Cain and Abel become an example of that when one of them is a tiller and one of them is a herder, and there is this tension between the groups, and it ends in violence. And then we see Hagar and Ishmael being evicted from the home of Sarah and Abraham. Well, if you don't get along with somebody, kick them out, right? All these things still happen, right? And this too is violent. And it leaves Hagar and Ishmael desperate. And there, Sacks introduces this term he calls counter-narrative, where the main narrative is that Isaac is chosen. But the counter-narrative is that Ishmael is not unchosen. And then comes what we lift up as one of the main themes of this lens of looking at the book. It would be presumptuous to say it's the main theme of the book. You can read it through a whole bunch of lenses like this. But the main theme of this read is what happens to our empathy. And everybody in the room felt for Hagar. The way the story is told, Hagar is desperate, her baby is under a tree, she doesn't want to hear the baby die. you know, and it's wrenching. And the same thing happens then with Rachel and Leah in the middle of the Jacob story. Jacob is the patron saint of looking out for number one, all right? So if you can't get along with your sibling, then just make sure you get as much as you can. Well, does this happen in family? Anybody got an inheritance story in the room? So we've got Jacob, who is named Grabber. And then this amazing story of transformation. How when his servants come to say, Esau is coming, and he has 400 men with him. I mean, the only thing we're missing in the story is a soundtrack, right? The drama of facing the brother that you have wronged. And so the story then turns to Jacob coming to terms with himself for the sake of this wonderful reconciliation with Esau. Now, as a firstborn, I've confessed my lens. I am a firstborn. I grieve that the Bible doesn't tell us a story of the conversion of Esau. What made Esau open and available to receive that? And I shared in the forum last night, I was really challenged yesterday by Gary's session and his suggestion that we need everybody at the table, we need white supremacists, KKK, NRA. I don't know how to do that. And I don't know how to help an NRA person know they'd be safe at my table. I don't know how to help me feel like I'd be safe, but that's my problem. There are therapists in the room. Maybe I'll talk to you. So what we're after then is this, is we've been pressing this for what is a Christian response to an interfaith world? What is our relationship to interfaith neighbors? Is it faithful to evict them, or is it more faithful to think about standing side by side with them, being reconciled on a level, living with? Theology is all done in prepositions. Is it living over, or is it living with? Is it living through? Is it living by? The prepositions define the relationship, and that's really crucial. I've been waiting all week to tell you about Anne Lamott's new TED Talk. Any Anne Lamott fans in the room? Have you seen her new TED Talk? The 12 things she's sure about? It is hilarious. So, for example, she says, food, and there's a long dramatic pause. She says, try to do better. I think you know what I mean. When she gets to family, she says, family. Families are very, 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 very difficult, no matter how much you love each other. She goes on to say, Earth is a laboratory for forgiveness. We should start with those at our dining room table, so that we can do it in comfortable pants. I'm wearing my most comfortable pants. So you see the movement of the book. Now, I want to thank you for your participation in sessions. I get to be the repository of all these great comments and questions that come all day long, you know, every meal. It's been wonderful to be in conversation with you. Thank you. Yesterday after the session, I got a question that I have a hunch haunts lots of us in the room, and I've decided to take it up in front of all of you. And I'll try to do it briskly because we've got a long story to deal with. The question was, what do we do with the verse, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father but by me. The people are nodding. See, other people have had this. When we start to talk about interfaith relationships, it feels like a violation. That we should be showing other people that Jesus is the way. What I would like to, I agree, we should be showing people that Jesus is the way. But what does it mean to show people that Jesus is the way? I like to say of that verse that Jesus makes a way where there is no way. That Jesus creates openings and relationship and reconciliation and forgiveness. And as I read the story of Jesus, that is not limited to the people who expect to get that relationship, and that people do not end up all looking or sounding alike when that relationship is created. Eugene Peterson says that we need to do the Jesus truth in the Jesus way, by which he means Jesus did not hit people over the head with a sledgehammer about which way to take. Jesus accepted people where they start, lived with them, loved them, blessed them, and moved them. Where I think this becomes most problematic is that in so many ways we talk about the way, or more often salvation, like a possession. I have salvation. I don't think that's accurate or possible any more than to say, I have a marriage. To have a marriage is to live in a moving, dynamic relationship. So the word I love to use for salvation is deliverance. It's a biblical word. We are delivered. To say that salvation means we are moved. I used to tell my confirmants, a delivered pizza is a moved pizza. All right? And so the way of Jesus is a movement. Before we were called Christian in the Bible, we were called people of the way, people on the move. And this is a way to God, or more accurately, it's God's way to us, in us and through us, but it's also our way to others. And Jesus himself is going to press that way until we're willing to consider that way for our enemies. You know, you've heard it said, love your brother, but I say to you, love your enemy. And what Paul Rode is saying to you in this class is that sometimes they're the same person. Right? And so today, we've seen this all along when we've been talking about where does your empathy go between Hagar and Sarah, between Leah and Rachel, and inevitably it is to the weaker, it is to the outcast, it is to the one who is misjudged. And today we're going to think about Jesus as God's way of creating empathy. The incarnation, first of all, is God's empathy with us, but also this way of creating empathy with others. One last way to interpret this. What do we mean by Jesus is the way? The other thing we've talked about all along the way is that there are different portrayals of power. So Cain has violent power, Jacob has grabbing power, there's manipulation, there's dishonesty. What is the power that works? And when all these stories are subverting birth order, I really think what they're doing is subverting power and saying it isn't the biggest, oldest, strongest who prevails, but it is the least, which is what Jesus said. And so Jesus shows us the power of surrender, the power of trust, the power of compassion and concern for others. And I really, if you read Sack's book, he's a Jewish writer, but he's got huge understanding of Christianity and appreciation for Christianity, and calls us, I think, to being truthful to what our own power claims us to be. So my question at the end is going to be, is relating to interfaith neighbors in an empathic, compassionate, accepting way less Christian, or is it more? What is the way? What is the way of Jesus, and how do we live on the way? So for whatever that's worth, no extra charge. I thought it was a great question. So we've been telling sibling stories, but we got a long story to go, so we're going to keep this real brisk, and it doesn't have to be about your siblings. Just turn to your neighbor and say, what has taught you empathy? Where have you learned empathy? Either by somebody being empathic with you, or you discovering empathy for someone else. Talk to each other, just for a second. Well, more than a second. Okay. Come back together. We've got great reading ahead, I promise. Just a couple examples. Where did you learn empathy? Any examples? I just got one really easy one with my own brother. We went to the same college. He's 2 years younger than I, so he came along 2 years later. And he was going through freshman adjustment and academic challenge and all the kinds of things that happen in your first year of college. And one time, it was one of the first really good adult-like talks we ever had. And he said, you know, Paul, I am not having a first year of college like you had. And he said, I said, what do you mean? Well, he said, everything went just fine for you. And I said, well, that's what I wrote home. And then I told him some about how the year had gone, which is to say, I get it. You know, I get it, and I experienced it too, but we're both first generation college. Our parents were very anxious about what this was going to be. I was not going to feed that anxiety. So I just, and it, you know, we didn't communicate every 20 minutes like college students do now. You know, there was one letter a week, and I would write it when I was in a good mood. but it really was a great point of connection. Where have you learned empathy? Go ahead, Mom.
So I think yours is similar to mine. Shared experiences, but not necessarily. My sister's a I won't type person. I won't ever get married. I won't ever have children. I won't ever, ever. And when my husband and I were first married, every time she wanted to do something with me, she's like, I don't understand why you need to check in with him. Like, it feels like he's controlling you. And then she got married. And she said, oh, I get it. you have to check in with your spouse. Yeah. And the same with children.
Yeah. One of my all-time favorite lines was a friend who told us when we were pregnant, and they had had a baby before, she just smiled and said, I raised several perfect children before I had my own. Oh, there's empathy. One more example.
One flaw to your initial comment. Today's students do communicate every 20 minutes, but not with their parents.
Oh, okay. There you go. So, I mean, another question is, with whom do we have empathy? And in some ways, that's the question we're working on. What Sacks is helping us see the Bible alerting us to is if we only have empathy with people who are like us, or if we can find empathy that extends beyond our groupishness, that's the question. Okay, Genesis 37. While you're looking it up, how many of you have seen Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat? Loved it, loved it, loved it, loved it. And helped, I think, you know, if you can let that music ring through your head as we're reading this text, the musical follows the text. Andrew Lloyd Webber did a great job with it. And the way the brothers are kind of doofuses and provide comic relief, I absolutely love hearing the brothers in the text through that musical. When I'm done, we're always jammed at the end because there's 64 more things we should be talking about. But do remind me to react to the end of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, because this is a very significant way. It's very different than the way Genesis ends. So we'll want to pay attention to that. Chapter 37, here it comes. Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, the father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel is also Jacob. Remember when Jacob wrestled at the river Jabbok, he was renamed Israel. So we're talking about one person here. Jacob is Israel. Loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age. He was also the son of his favorite wife. And he made him a long robe with sleeves. There are literally more colorful translations that say the multicolored robe, and hence the Amazing Technicolor dream coat. But when his brothers saw their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. We've seen this again and again and again. In fact, yesterday we had the tally. Love is used 11 times in the book of Genesis, and it creates conflict, resentment, hatred every time. Once Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. Good clue for reading the Bible, pay attention to what's repeated. How do you really feel about this guy, brothers? You know, in case you missed it the first time, here it comes again. He said to them, listen to this dream that I dreamed. All right, Joseph, go ahead. Salt in the wounds. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright. Then your sheaves gathered around it and bowed down to my sheaf. His brother said to him, are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us? So they hated him even more because of his dreams and his words. He had another dream and told it to his brother, saying, look, I had another dream. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars are bowing down to me. I mean, how could Broadway resist this? Really? But when he told it to his father and to his brothers, his father rebuked and said to him, what kind of dream is this that you have had? Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow to the ground before you? So his brothers were jealous of him, and his father kept the matter in mind. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. He answered, here I am. So he said to him, go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. He came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering in the fields. The man asked him, what are you seeking? He said, I'm seeking my brothers. He said, tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock. The man said, they've gone away, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. These are herders, of course, so they're meandering. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near him, they conspired to kill him. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. Okay, so we've got this going on. I should have had this before. The relationship of love and hate repeatedly. I love this quote from Sack's book. To create a universe, Genesis implies, is easy. It takes no more than a single chapter. To create a human relationship is difficult. Families are very, very, very hard. Jacob's love for Joseph, innocent, human, benign, generates envy and hate. It is this honest confrontation with complexity that makes Genesis so profound a religious text. So then in verse 18, it is the verse we're on right now, they see him from a distance. Sack says, on the surface it means what it says. They saw him approach, I mean he was far away, and they planned murder. At another level, however, it is a philosophical statement about love and hate. They were able to contemplate fratricide because they saw him at a distance. How we see one another. So Augustana, where I work, is owned by an association of congregations in South Dakota, Nebraska, Western Iowa, and Southwest Minnesota. And once a year, this association meets, and we do some kind of program. So a couple, 3 years ago, as we were just starting our really deliberate interfaith work, we decided to do our program that year on what we were doing with interfaith and think about how we can be a resource for congregations as increasingly they are living in multicultural interfaith worlds. I have students from Southern Minnesota now who are the last classes, last graduating seniors from their high schools that will be Anglo majority. And so I started the program saying to them, you have whatever perceptions you have of flyover country. I come humbly to you in the mountains. I live on flyover country. I said to them, how many of you, of your congregations, have children marrying people of other faiths? Let's just, how many of your congregations have children marrying people of other faiths? See the hands? Yeah. More hands up than not. One of the reasons we're starting to see this in the Bible is because other faiths are coming close. We used to see them at a distance, and then it was sort of an academic pursuit. But there's not so much nobility in this because it has come to us. These questions are come to us, and that's why we're seeking wisdom, I think, from our own sacred text about how to respond to this. It's fascinating to me with the Bible. I mean, when we read and study the Bible, we there's always this question, and are we studying the Bible or are we studying our lenses with which we see it? The very first time I taught at Holden, I taught ecological theology. And I went to seminary in a day when I was taught that the Bible is about the redemption of humankind and natural theology is wrong. You shouldn't go there. And I started to question that, and Holden is a good place to come and teach when you're questioning something like that. I was finding natural theology everywhere, including and most especially from Jesus, whom Clarence Jordan says the Carpenters Union convinced us was a carpenter. Anybody who's read the New Testament knows Jesus was a farmer. There is not a, well, there's the foundation, the build on the foundation metaphor. Otherwise, it's farm metaphors top to bottom. So, I appreciated Sack stopping me here to say, because we would just read that as narrative detail, right? Setting, but it's more than narrative detail. As life comes close, then you get a new look at your sacred text and what you need to learn from it. Okay?
May I offer just one?
Yeah, please.
Because I keep thinking about this. I heard Elie Wiesel, before he died years ago, speak, and he said, we're living in a world where we can send people to the moon, but have we learned any better from the Cain and Abel story about how to love our brother?
Yeah.
And I loved that because he was so clear about the relevance of what we're doing.
Absolutely. And I hope you're hearing me be clear that I'm not just challenging our relationship to interfaith. I'm challenging our understanding of family. I tell every couple I marry that I think the greatest threat to married couples is isolation. We have a very insular definition of family. And it is not sustainable. Every family needs a community, needs connection, needs the wisdom of other people. So we always need to be challenging that, you know, so this the whole distance thing. I mean, when you're talking about your brother, of course, you can get too close to, you know, not just see from a distance this sort of, we're never objective about our siblings, but not too close either, or not only this close insular kind of thing. Okay, we'll keep moving. Verse 19. They said to one another, here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. We shall see indeed. There's a lot of story ahead of us.
Yeah.
Now pay attention to who says what here. This matters when we get to the conclusion. So Reuben is a son of Leah. Reuben heard it, he delivered, he moved him out of their hands, saying, let us not take his life. Reuben said to them, shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father. So when Joseph came, the other thing I just realized, Reuben is a firstborn. Oh, well. So in case I forget it by the time we get there, he's the one who's going to say, I told you so. Another spoiler alert. So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Well, some of you who've been here all week know about Ishmael and therefore Ishmaelites. What does this evoke? A different option. Kick him out, right? That's what we did with Ishmael, with their camels carrying gum, balm, and resin on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands. Remember, this is Judah now speaking. And not lay our hands on him, for he is not our brother, our own flesh. For he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where can I turn?" Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They had the long robe with sleeves taken to their father, and they said, "This we found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not." Jacob recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his sons many days. All his sons and all his daughters sought to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father bewailed him. Again, repetition. How many times does it say, "Mourned, mourned, bewailed, mourned, I'll never get over it," he said. Meanwhile, the Midianites had said to him in Egypt, to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. Till one day this week I mentioned to you that I would call myself a narrative theologian. When I started my doctorate in narrative theology, I told my students, I'm doing this to convince you that your lives are stories and not answers. This is another way to talk about Jesus and the way. The way is a story. It's dynamic and it's moving. From my students' point of view, I totally get it. It looks like figuring out a vocation, figuring out a life partner. These are answers. And when I get the answer, then I'll have the answer. It's like, no, these are themes in your story. And sometimes your vocation is front and center, but it only takes one word, biopsy, and your vocation will not be so much front and center. Then there's another theme in your story and how the story goes. Well, what I love about this book is the way all, you know, I tried to give you this brief synopsis, all the themes come together. So we've got murder, or at least the appearance of murder, which turns out to be deceit. We've had deceit all along. We've had hatred and envy and favoritism and youngest and oldest. And this great foreshadowing, you know, are we to bow down to you? I mean, you've seen the play, and so you know where we're headed. And we're going to have to jump around in order to get through this, but the detail about Egypt is fabulous. So Potiphar's house, there's this incident with Potiphar's wife, and that lands Joseph in prison. And then there are the cook and the baker end up in prison. They should have read this text when you read the Benedictine rule about kitchen behavior. The baker and the cook end up in prison, and they're haunted by their dreams, and Joseph interprets their dreams. Well, then they get out of prison. In the meantime, the Pharaoh has dreams about five fat cows and five lean cows, and the baker is able to say, "Well, I know somebody who can interpret your dreams." Irony of irony, Joseph ends up in the Pharaoh's house, interprets the dreams, that it means there are going to be 7 years of plenty, and then there are going to be 7 years of want. So we need to use the words of plenty to save food for the years of want. Sure enough, the years of plenty happen. Egypt has this storehouse of food, and the famine comes. And Joseph's brothers are starving. But Jacob has heard that there is food in Egypt. And in the meantime, Rachel has had another baby named Benjamin. Sends all the sons to Egypt except Benjamin, because he's already lost his beloved Joseph. And he's not willing to risk his beloved Benjamin. And so we're going to pick the story up again. In Genesis 42, 1 through 38. When Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you keep looking at one another? I have heard," he said, "that there is grain in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt, but Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers, for he feared that harm might come to him. Thus the sons of Israel were among the other people who came to buy grain, for the famine had reached the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land, and it was he who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came, da-da-da-da, we need a soundtrack, and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. When Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Although Joseph had recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Joseph also remembered the dreams that he had dreamed about them. Okay, my new word for the year is the word contronym. Any of you know that word? Contronym is a single word that has opposite meanings. So the word fast in English, for example, can mean immovable, or it can mean moving quickly. The word cleave can mean divide, like a cleaver, to cleave the meat from the bone, or it can mean to unite, as in a man cleaves to his wife. The word dust can mean apply fine particles as you dust your garden or your fields, or it can mean remove fine particles as in dusting your furniture. This contronym, isn't that fascinating? I had never heard this word before, but Sachs taught it to me. And teaches us that the root word NKR in Hebrew can mean recognize or be a stranger to. The same word is a contronym. And it gets used four times here in these two verses. That Joseph recognized him, but they didn't recognize him. And he was a stranger to them, but he recognized them. And it goes back and forth. I think it's the perfect word to define our siblings. There are no people in the universe we know better and don't know at all. Right? We should come up.
Your children.
Huh?
Your children.
I'll grant you that. Okay. There are no, but your family, right? Yeah. Yeah, your children. Who are you and where did you come from? And the irony that we probably have that reaction when they are being most like us, right? So contronym, I mean, it speaks to all kinds of things, but it is this fascinating narrative detail that there is recognition and there is not recognition. And I've done enough interfaith work now to be just astonished at how many parallels there can be at exactly the point at which we seem so different and how to live and work in this. I've loved Greg's sessions about Buddhism because he has a way of doing it that makes it so similar to Christianity. But I'm still yearning for kind of the clarification. I hear more distinction between Christianity and Buddhism that he does, but that's, I mean, that's the one rivalry. There you go. And the irony of the dreams. Okay, we'll keep going. Joseph said to them, "You are spies. You've come to see the nakedness of the land." They said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man." Well, they have no idea the truth of which they speak. We are all sons of the same man. "We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." But he said to them, "No, you've come to see the nakedness of the land." I mean, he's toying with them. It's marvelous. It makes a great kid story. He said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the son of a certain man in the land of Canaan. The youngest, however, is now with our father, and one is no more." But Joseph said to them, it is just as I have said to you, you are spies. Here is how you shall be tested. As Pharaoh lives, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes. Let one of you go and bring your brother, while the rest of you remain in prison, in order that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you, or else as Pharaoh lives, surely you are spies. And he put them all together in prison for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers stay here where you are imprisoned. The rest of you shall go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me. Thus your words will be verified, and you shall not die." And they agreed to do so. They said to one another, "Alas, we are paying the penalty for what we did to our brother. We saw his anguish when he pleaded with us, but we would not listen. That is why this anguish has come upon us." Again, another theme that we've seen all along is that Jacob is dishonest, doesn't really have the awakening until dishonesty happens to him and he gets the other wife, you know. He thinks it's great that the youngest shall serve the oldest until he gets the oldest wife first, has another 7 years to work for. You see how these themes have come and how this is building, they're remembering what they did to their brother because now it's starting to happen to them. So he turned to, then Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to wrong the boy? You know, the firstborn, I told you so, but you would not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood them, since he spoke with them through an interpreter. He turned away from them and wept. And then he returned and spoke to them. And he picked out Simeon and had him bound before their eyes. Joseph then gave orders to fill their bags with grain, to return every man's money to his sack, to give them provisions for their journey. This was done for them. Now, this is a little detail that's going to become really important in the next chapter. I mean, it's this extravagance. And this is sort of Joseph being the new Esau, who's able to receive this. And so he not only gives them grain, but he gives them all their money back. And so they take off, and when they open their sacks and find money, they're scared to death because that really is going to make them look like criminals and spies. But this is going to become an important detail for the next. I think we're going to stop there and go to verse 40 or chapter 43, and we'll read just a little bit of 43 and 44, because it would be a tragedy if you don't get to the end of the story. Verse 43, 26. And so the brothers have gone, and they've had this very emotional time with Jacob, or Israel, Jacob slash Israel. And saying, you know, Simeon's in prison in Egypt, and we've got to take Benjamin to Egypt. And so Benjamin is now coming with them. And this will be the first time then that Joseph gets to meet Benjamin. And I have lost battery. I will speak.
Just what? Check the board connection.
I think everything is plugged in.
I'll go left.
Is this cording?
Thanks, all. Mostly this is reading, and you've got the text in front of you. I'll read as loud as I can. 43:26. So we've got the second meeting of Joseph and his brothers, this time with Benjamin. When Joseph came home, they brought him the present that they had carried into the house and bowed to the ground before him. He inquired about their welfare and said, "Is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive?" They said, "Your servant, our father, is well. He is still alive." And they bowed their heads and did obeisance. Then he looked up and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, "Is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? God be gracious to you, my son." With that, Joseph hurried out because he was overcome with affection for his brother. And he was about to weep, so he went into a private room and wept there. Then he washed his face and came out. Well, it's like something out of I Love Lucy. just overwhelmed. On the other hand, it's really full of pathos and emotion. I mean, imagine hearing that your father is still alive and getting to meet your brother who was innocent of the crime and all of the rest of it. Then he washed his face and came out, and controlling himself, he said, "Serve the meal." They served him by himself and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with them by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat with Hebrews, and so on. Okay, so, and then we'll go to 44. Start 44. Then he commanded the servant of his house, "Fill the men's sacks with food as much as they can carry, and put each man's money on the top of his sack." We've heard this before. "Put my cup, the silver cup, in the top of the sack of the youngest, with his money for the grain." And he did as Joseph told him. Thank you. As soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away with their donkeys. When they had gone only a short distance from the city, Joseph said to his steward, "Go follow after them, and when you overtake them, say to them, 'Why have you returned evil for good? Why have you stolen my silver cup? Is it not from this that my Lord drinks? Does he not indeed use it for divination? You have done wrong in doing this.'" You know, I don't know if Victor Hugo used this for inspiration for Les Misérables, but I can't imagine, Emily, that he didn't. When Jean Valjean is out of prison and the bishop is merciful to him, and he takes the silver, it just rings so familiar to me. A good man.
My power is restored. We believe in redemption. When he overtook them, he repeated these words to them. They said to him, "Why does my Lord speak such words as thee? Far be it from your servants that they should do such a thing. Look, the money that we found at the top of our sacks, we brought back to you from the land of Canaan. Why then would we steal silver or gold from your Lord's house? Should it be found with any one of your servants, let him die." Oh, beware, you know, what you say. "Moreover, the rest of us will become my Lord's slaves." He said, "Even so, in accordance with your words, let it be. He with whom it is found shall become my slave, for the rest of you shall go free." Then each one quickly lowered his sack to the ground, and each opened his sack. He searched, beginning with the eldest and ending with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. At this they tore their clothes. Then each one loaded his donkey, and they returned to the city. Judah, remember Judah? Judah was the one who proposed selling Joseph in the first place. Okay? Really important detail. Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house while he was still there, and they fell to the ground before him. Joseph said to him, "What deed is it that you have done?" And Joseph knows this is a foil, a setup. Joseph has set all this up. "Do you not know that one such as I can practice divination?" Judah said, "What can we say to my Lord? What can we speak? How can we clear ourselves? God has found out the guilt of your servants. Here we are then, my Lord's slave, both we and also the one in whose possession the cup has been found." But he said, "Far be it from me that I should do so. Only the one in whose possession the cup was found shall be my slave. But as for you, go up in peace to your father." Okay, what is Joseph saying? Only Benjamin has to stay. The rest of you go. Is it back? It's on.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, but Rolf went and got me a battery.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yep, so I've got a new battery. Thank you very much. That only Benjamin has to say. So then Judah stepped up to him and said, "Oh, my Lord, let your servant please speak a word in my Lord's ears, and do not be angry with your servant, for you are like Pharaoh himself. My Lord asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we said to my Lord, 'We have a father, an old man, and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead. He alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me so that I may set my eyes on him.' We said to my Lord, 'The boy cannot leave his father, for if he should leave his father would die.' Then you said to your servants, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you shall see my face no more.'
When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him the words of my Lord. And when our father said, go again, buy us a little food, we said, we cannot go down. Only if our youngest brother goes with us will we go down. For we cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Then your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One left me, and I said, surely he has been torn to pieces, and I have never seen him since. If you take this one also from me, and harm comes to him, you will bring down my gray hairs in sorrow to Sheol. Now therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the boy is not with us, then as his life is bound up in the boy's life, when he sees that the boy is not with us, he will die, and your servants will bring down the gray hairs of your servant, our father, with sorrow to Sheol. For your servant became surety for the boy to my father, saying, if I do not bring him back to you, then I will bear the blame in the sight of my father all my life. Now, therefore, please let your servant remain as a slave to my Lord in place of the boy, and let the boy go back with his brothers. I submit to you that this is not the same Judah that sold his brother into slavery, right? That Judah was angry, he was envious, he was full of hatred, he conceived the act, he's like, oh no, we're not gonna kill him, but let's sell him. And now, here comes this guy with, how many verses did we read of compassion for his father and what it will do to his father if Benjamin doesn't return? Therefore, he says, let me stay in prison so that Benjamin can go back. So it's this next marvelous story of empathy, or what Sachs is going to call empathy. The source of our violence lies in our need to exist in groups, in in-group altruism and out-group hostility. It follows that the most profound moralizing experience, the only one capable of defeating dualism, is to undergo the reversal. That, in essence, is what Joseph is forcing his brothers to do. He is putting them through the intensely painful, yet morally transformative ordeal of role reversal. This at last subverts or undoes the relationship between love and hate. When you start to see the story through the eyes of the person you have hated, this at last turns the crank, and we have reversal. So Sachs is going to give us a new, at least to me, it's a new definition of repentance out of this. He says, perfect repentance comes about when you find yourself in the same situation, but this time you act differently. So Judah is in exactly the same situation. His youngest brother could be a slave in Egypt. But this time, instead of saying hurrah, Judah says, no, let me be the slave to Egypt. So, I mean, there are all these stories in the village this week about how to serve justice, how to be an intervening bystander, how to confront racism in a helpful way. And my contribution to that is going to be to say, let's remember that our lives are stories and not answers. It's not like we're going to find a story or an answer, but I do believe that Jesus is the way, and we will find a way. And the story gives us characters with whom we can identify, and through whose eyes we can begin to see our world in different ways. So, I mean, we think about the way we learn, I am at the implication side, not to commit evil is to experience an event from the perspective of the victim. So we want to, what does role reversal mean in our day, and what does it mean in an interfaith world? One of the things I'm proposing it means is that we become willing to see the world through our neighbor's eyes. So there are Christian women who are wearing headscarves for a day, going through their world in a headscarf to see what that feels like. How do people react to them and what happens? Or my favorite story in this, I'm so proud of this, though I can take no credit for it. One of the hospitals in our town is called McKinnon. It was started by an order of Roman Catholic sisters called the Presentation Sisters. And 20 years ago, when an increasing number of doctors coming to the hospital were Muslim, the Presentation Sisters bought property and started the Muslim Community Center because they wanted their neighbors to feel at home. I think that is empathy, you know. And I'm grateful that the Muslim Community Center is there because it becomes the place that my students not only get some faith literacy, get to learn about Islam, but get to know Muslims, get to know them as people, as human beings. Apart from the cardboard cutouts that we're exposed to in the news, we've got a comment here. You got?
I'm just burning to say, when my wife was trying to explain to some friends about the problems with covering people's hair, talking to the Roman Catholic group, she said, well, the nuns covered their hair and wore very similar garments for centuries, so that's the deal.
Right, right. You know, one of the things we talked about, I guess that was the Jacob Day, that would be Wednesday, was how, in one sense we're talking interfaith, in another sense we're talking intra-faith, because of the kind of suspicion we face when we will stretch and when we will move. And there's a great documentary on Netflix. It's called Radical Grace. And it is the story of American orders of nuns who underwent investigation by the Vatican for their fidelity in the last several years, because the Vatican was calling their fidelity into question. It spurred largely from the Affordable Care Act, and the Council of Bishops in Roman Catholicism came out strongly against it because they were afeared that public money would be spent on abortions. But the nuns who work among the poor knew that the health care is inaccessible and that insurance was needed, so they came out strongly for it. And it is a marvelous story, and it parallels the sibling rivalry, you know, and the nuns speak with great candor about what it was like to be under investigation by the same church that had taught them everything they knew. You know, they thought they were being faithful. And I will say that in my own place. It's like, look, I'm a Lutheran, and we believe in grace, and now you're faulting me for being gracious to our international students. Come on. Is this more Christian or less Christian? So we've got only a few minutes. We need to turn to Genesis 50 and hear the end of the story. This great moment. When Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. Genesis 50. Verse 15. Realizing that their father was dead, Joseph's brother said, "What if Joseph still bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong that we did to him?" So they approached Joseph, saying, "Your father gave this instruction before he died. Say to Joseph, I beg you, forgive the crime of your brothers and the wrong they did in harming you. Now, therefore, please forgive the crime of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also wept, fell down before him and said. I mean, again, this is a narrative repetition. The culmination of the Isaac-Ishmael story was when they come together at Abram's grave. And so Jacob has died and they are grieving together. "We are here as your slaves." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? Even though you intended to do harm to me, God intended it for good, in order to preserve a numerous people as he is doing today. So have no fear. I myself will provide for you and your little ones." In this way, he reassured them, speaking kindly to them. So the book of Genesis is about goodness. It's bracketed by goodness, this marvelous creation story at the beginning, and everything God creates is good. And then we have this long 50-year sojourner where goodness is hard to see at a lot of times. But through role reversal and empathy and the culminating story, Joseph again says, God meant it for good. And not just for me, but for good for all the brothers and all the little ones and all the siblings. So my argument with Andrew Lloyd Webber, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat ends with them singing, go, 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 Joseph, you know, and Donny Osmond flies. I saw it with Donny Osmond. And that's where it ends. And I was just devastated. This verse was not included in the musical. The book ends, we always love the book better, right? The book ends with Joseph praising a God of goodness. A long-suffering, patient, persistent God who is willing to go, not only to go this long, windy path with us, but to put all of us on long, windy paths with glimmers of goodness and hope and reconciliation, but calls to compassion and generosity all along the way. So it seems to me that we should end, go, 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 God, right? with confidence that God will, confidence and hope and willingness to participate, that God will endure. Thank you so much for your participation. It's been a privilege to be with you. So, safe travels, or for those of you staying in the village, we'll see you Monday.